This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Conservationists are familiar with using field guides for butterflies, mammals, birds. But for economics? Two UVM professors say it's a natural fit. They've written a field guide to economics for conservationists, and they argue that conservationists need to have a firm grasp on economics. After all, economic forces are at the heart of issues like habitat loss, land use patterns, and government regulations. So conservationists need to understand these factors if they want to be effective in their work. Brendan Fisher is a research associate professor at the Rubenstein School of Environmental and Natural Resources. Taylor Ricketts is a professor and director of the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics. Along with Robin Nadeau, they wrote this guide, and they are with us today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So you write at the beginning of the book that the causes of biodiversity loss are grounded in economics. Can you give us an example so we can wrap our head around what we're talking about here?
Sure.
Brendan?
I think that... If we think about one of the biggest conservation issues of the last 30 years, we can talk about the deforestation of the Brazilian Amazon. The drivers of that have been the demand for global demand for timber, global demand for basically hamburgers, so cattle pasturing, as well as the proliferation of soy being planted in the Amazon. So all of those things are economic, global economic drivers to deforest one of the most important places on Earth for biodiversity. When we think about some of the solutions to those problems, we're seeing a downturn in deforestation when the global economy fails, when the cost of monitoring deforestation goes down, and when we can come up with incentives, so reducing subsidies and coming up with incentives to conserve the forest. So all of those things are about economics, and they center on one of the most important places on Earth for biodiversity.
And perhaps it would be a misunderstanding for people to think, well, you're seeing deforestation go down. It must be because conservation is taking hold, and this idea that you need to preserve the rainforest, that's working, when in fact you're saying part of it is due to the global economy and the downturn a few years ago, that there just wasn't enough money for people to continue cutting up the forest and put those herds in or put that soy in.
Yeah, that's part of it. But also, there has been some recognition about the wider values of keeping forest in forest. So there's really interesting work going on now showing how important remaining forest, healthy forest, is to producing hydroelectric power coming off Amazonian rainforest. So there's a real economic driver to conserve the forest as well.
Taylor, you've written this field guide to introduce conservationists to the really big theories in economics. Do conservationists need to know those really big theories? I mean, if you're working on Amazon deforestation versus what's happening with bobolinks in Vermont, they may both be based on economic issues, but really don't you just need to know what's happening in your community and what the human forces are? Do you need to understand supply and demand and cost-benefit analyses?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think one of the funnest parts about writing the book and one of the most important parts of it is that thinking like an economist actually clarifies a lot of issues. It lets you spot the economic problems that lead to things like everything from Amazonian deforestation to problems with Lake Champlain here locally. And it also points to the solutions coming out. So it's not just about sort of local day-to-day work, but the theories involved. And I think that's why we framed it as a field guide. You know, a bird guide doesn't make you an ornithologist. And this book won't make you an economist, but it'll tell you what you need to know to spot things out there in the world and understand them a little bit better. That's the gift that field guides give us. We learn to identify birds, and suddenly we have a new lens for looking at the world. We think that this is a lens for looking at the world that helps clarify it and point to the solutions a little more clearly than if you didn't understand things like opportunity costs and supply and demand and things like that.
How would a book like this have helped you when you were starting out?
Oh, this is one of the reasons I helped write the book, is because I could have really used it. It would have saved me 15 years of painful learning on my own and trying to understand Brendan and Robin when they spoke. You know, I'm a trained biologist who just learned slowly that economics was at the heart of all these problems, whether it's local or global. And so just by working with economists, I sort of picked things up. I would have saved myself a lot of time and pain just by having a book like this. So I think it would have helped me get a clear grasp of things quickly and all at once so I could get down to work as opposed to stumble my way through it. And that's what we're hoping to provide for others.
We're talking today about the intersection of economics and conservation, and I'm sure a lot of listeners have questions for you or their own ideas about where they see these intersections happening and why it's important to have a good base of knowledge in each. If you're among them, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That number again is 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Mark who says, in the end, it's all about incentives. Conservationists will ultimately be unsuccessful in their efforts if they rely on the argument that it's just the right thing to do, whatever the it happens to be. Sure, you'll make some progress because there's always a small number of individuals willing to give their time and treasure. But for broader success, a sound economic argument with plenty of data to support it will provide the right incentives to more people who have more money to jump on the bandwagon. If conservationists can show someone they'll lose less money or be eligible for a certain tax break through conserving or be able to create a new business opportunity by conserving, then their causes will be more successful. It's all about the money and the incentives in this economy, especially in Vermont. Altruism just won't be enough. Does that resonate with you? Is that part of understanding this book? If you can understand economic forces, then you can better sway people to your cause. I see you guys going back and forth. Who wants to answer?
Yeah, well, I'd just say I'd like Mark to write a review of our book.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Oh,
we should have invited him to help us write it.
Yeah, he could be a co-author. I think more seriously, though, I mean, that's a very strong point. And we use cost-benefit analysis of the frame as the frame in this book. So I think it's quite obvious that people respond to incentives. That's one of the fundamentals of economics. But people, the things that incentivize people aren't necessarily always economic. Now, that is a strong driver and probably one of the strongest drivers of our decision making. But also, people like to do things out of volunteering, out of the intrinsic value that they have for something. I think when it comes down to policy, especially a lot of the places where Taylor and I work are in the developing world, the economic and market incentive is very strong. When you're working in a place where most of the people are food insecure, they need more farming, more production, et cetera, that economic incentive is going to be very strong.
There's a good example right here in Vermont, too, I must say, leading from Mark's great comment. So we all know about Hurricane Irene and the flooding that it caused in every town in Vermont. One of those is Middlebury, also Rutland, both in the Otter Creek. And there's a system of wetlands in between those two towns that many people think slowed down the flood and alleviated it for Middlebury, which suffered much less damage than Rutland did. So one of the projects going on to the Gund Institute where we work is to estimate the economic value of that. So what is the value in terms of dollars, in terms of flood mitigation, costs avoided, damages avoided to Middlebury of these wetlands? And it's between $1 and $2 million just for Middlebury just that year, and about $500,000 every year on average is what they can expect. And that, I think, gets to Mark's point of understanding the economics of conservation, not just as a cost preventing you from doing something that might make you money, but actually as an investment in something that does.
Well, and you also introduce in the book this idea that you have to be able to put a value on nature and wildlife. And that seems like that may be something that you have to push a little harder with conservationists on. Not that they're not already thinking about value and why ecosystems are important to preserve, but this idea that you need to put a dollar sign on a bird or you need to put a dollar sign on a tree might seem sort of antithetical to why people get into the conservation field in the first place. So why is it important to have that kind of economic basis for your work?
It is controversial. People in conservation debate it all the time. I think people are slowly, over time, coming to see the kind of practical importance of doing that. But there is some hesitation about sort of selling out nature or monetizing something that's precious and of infinite value to many people. But I think as a practical matter, decisions are made in a kind of cost-benefit framework a lot of times. And if we want nature to be entered in that decision and to have some say in the ledgers that govern decisions, they need to be assigned a value that's not zero. And we can be really careful about that, and we can say this doesn't mean that's the only way that it's valuable. There's intrinsic values that still pertain, but I think making it sort of a mainstream part of people's decisions is often going to require putting it in the units that people use to make those decisions, and that's sometimes, but not always, dollars.
So, and I think, I mean, we get into this in the book a little bit, but economists do care about value, but that doesn't mean profit maximizing monetary values all the time. So one of the strongest examples kind of in our field over the last few years was looking at the ability of coastal wetlands and mangrove forests to mitigate storms, so to slow down the tidal and water coming onto the coast of India during giant storms. And their value at the end of it was not in monetary terms, but in number of houses lost and number of people who died. So that's a value. That's a way to monetize, or not monetize, it's a way to give a metric to a cost or a benefit that doesn't necessarily relate to money. And we could do the same with the number of birds saved or the number of species protected. So we don't always have to move to money.
Do you always, though, have to move to humans? Do you always have to put it in a sort of a cost-benefit ratio to humans in order for people to understand the value of conservation or to look at the issue in a way that they can understand, okay, this is how this affects me?
No, we don't always have to do that. But I think doing that doesn't weaken the existing arguments for conservation as sort of an ethical or moral thing to do. I think it's just the case that there are some people who get it from a conservationist point of view that really have that value of conserving nature. And some people need to understand, in addition to that, how it affects their own well-being and whether they'll be better or worse off. So it's for that second group of people that I think economics is an additional effective argument, not a replacement.
I want to pause and just back right up to this idea of what is economics? Because I think many people studiously avoided taking an economics class in college. I wish I had taken one. And you make a point of saying right at the book, here's what economics is and here's what it isn't. It is not a doctrine. It is not just about making money. So what is economics, Brendan?
Go for it.
in 10 words or less, of course.
That's a great question. Yeah, so economics is basically just the study of how people make decisions with scarce resources. That's it. And so that means, why do we donate to charity? Why do we donate our kidneys to somebody we do not know? Those are economic issues. They're not typically what we think of because we have tied economics up with business and profiteering and markets. But really, the fundamental basis of economics is just the study of why people make decisions, how they make the decisions based on the available opportunities and the constraints in resources.
And you say that idea of scarcity is the key word there, because if you have all of the resources in the world, you don't have to make choices. You can just sort of do what you want.
That's right. It'd be like living like Beyonce.
Which would be wonderful. And scarcity, I imagine, is where you just right off the bat start to hook conservationists, because most people who are dealing with conservation understand that concept of scarcity. Do you find, Taylor, that people are saying, oh, okay, well, that I understand?
Yeah, they get it in two ways. Often conservationists are interested in species that are becoming rare. So they get this scarcity thing that some things are scarce, some things are common. Also, sadly, in my view, conservationists have operated under limited resources forever, right? We never have as much money as we think we need and so forth. So making tough choices when you can't have everything is just a way of life if you're the Nature Conservancy or some local land trust or something like that. And so that concept is familiar to everybody. And what I think is cool about the general definition of economics is it's happening all the time. It's running in your head constantly. All of us are making small cost-benefit decisions constantly. And so economics, as Brendan said, is not just about maximizing profit or the stock market or something. It's about how we make those decisions and whether we do that rationally and well. And from a conservation point of view, can we understand decisions so that they're made on average towards sustainability a little bit more than they are?
There are going to be times, though, I imagine, where you're not going to be able to make an effective economic argument for saving a species or saving habitat, where you're not going to be able to say, this comes out on the pro side of that pro-con list for you if you don't build in this forest, or where you might have to say, in order to preserve this habitat for this threatened species of owl, we are going to have to require you companies or you individuals to make less money and to have a less positive economic outcome than you would otherwise. How do you square that then? you know, with this argument that you can put conservation into economic terms and help people make rational decisions that help preserve or sustain our natural habitats.
Yeah, so economics isn't the answer. It just certainly helps us provide information to make better decisions. So I completely agree. There are places, there are times that we're going to say, we just need to do something to save polar bears or this owl. But economics, even once you make that decision, a societal or a moral or however you want to frame that decision, economics can actually help us to deliver how to do that in the most cost-effective way with the least hurt, and just really provide additional information to really, if we make a decision on the policy level, how do you get the biggest bang for your buck?
We're talking today with the authors of a new field guide to economics for conservationists. They say it's essential for people in the environmental and natural resources fields to have a better understanding of the economic forces that shape their work. Coming up, we're going to apply that to a few more local examples: forestation, maybe wild animal herd management, water conservation we've already talked about a little bit, pollution mitigation. You can share your thoughts if you've worked on citizen science projects, if you think about preservation, or if you think about building versus, conservation. How do you square those, and how do you think about it in your own life? What questions do you have about how economic applications can work in the conservation field? Our number is 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm talking with two UVM professors who've written a field guide for conservationists, but this one is a field guide to economics. Brendan Fisher and Taylor Ricketts say it's essential for people working in the fields of conservation, sustainability, and natural resources to understand basic economics if they want their work to have real-world impact. I might add, it's probably pretty crucial for all of us to have a sense of economic forces if we want to understand the world around us and if we want to know why we're making the choices that we make. What do you think? Where do you see the intersection of economics and conservation? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's dive right into a couple of local ideas and local concepts that I think can help ground us in what we're talking about. On this show in the past, several years ago, we talked about a bobolink project where bobolinks, a grassland bird, are facing habitat loss. And they're really struggling because often farmers or people who have these big fields come to hay them. And they hay them right at the time that the bobolinks are nesting. So it basically kills the next generation of bobolinks. Now, if the farmers could wait a little while, then the bobolinks could fledge their young, and then I think they do two fledgling sessions a year, but they could have that first one underway, they could survive, and the farmers could get their hay in. But it probably means the farmers don't get to hay as often as they might otherwise, certainly don't get to do it as early as they might otherwise, and lose money. So looking at that framework, how do we apply economic theories and economic motivations to figure out what to do in that kind of situation? Brendan?
Yeah, so I think that's a great example. And it ties back to your last question about monetizing things. So this is an example where we don't need to monetize the bobolinks. Like, how much is this bird worth? What we really need to do is understand if we care about it enough to offset the cost to the farmer. So by not haying, that farmer is incurring a cost. So what is that cost? And economics can help us figure that out. That's the cost of supplying additional feed to cattle, or the cost they would have lost selling that hay on the market. And then we can ask people, do you care enough about the bobolink? Does society care enough to offset that cost? And that's a very different question than saying, how much is the bobolink worth? And then so there's another interesting thing Taylor mentioned earlier, maybe offline, about externalities. Conservation is very concerned with externalities. What I do on my farm actually affects somebody else down the line. So you can think about the bobolink project where, okay, so if the farmer can't hay and we can offset that cost either by people contributing or some kind of market for, bird-friendly hay, that hay needs to come from somewhere else. So what's happening on that piece of land? So maybe there are other birds that are nesting on that piece of land. And so economics helps us give this framework of saying, okay, let's get all of the people that are relevant to this situation, and let's look at all the different stakeholders' views and the cost and the benefits of a decision.
This also gets to sort of why we wrote the book and sort of the concepts that can help out. So Brendan mentioned externalities, right? So once you understand what an externality is, this is kind of the field guide element. you can see them everywhere. So a farmer's decisions for their upside is having costs to other people. And that's, so it's an externality because it's external to that farmer's decision. It's not intrinsic to what he's going to do or what he's going to make on his farm. And so dealing with externalities, you can probably see them at the middle of almost every conservation problem in the world. Another one's an opportunity cost. That's a concept in the book, which is just the cost to that farmer of not haying or not haying so early. That's the cost of what he could have done had he not been helping us with bubble links. And so covering people's opportunity costs, the cost of doing the right thing, is a big part of the trick in getting economics to work for conservation as opposed to against it.
And when you talk about, you know, a concept, I haven't actually seen this on the market, but something like bird safe hay, bobolink safe hay, you know, you can think pretty quickly to the value added sort of portion of coffee, where it's bird safe coffee, that you can actually make some money by making a higher value product, whether it's higher value, you know, just by what it is, or because you can put some notes on it that say this is, you know, shade grown, bird safe, sustainably harvested coffee, and you're going to pay more for it because, you know, you value those things. So you can see that even as a part of the cost benefit analysis, that conservationists can say, all right, look, we're not going to pay you for this hay, but you can market your hay in a different way and maybe make more money than you could otherwise.
That's right. That coffee example is a classic way of people trying to fix an externality. It might cost the farmer a little bit more, but the most important point is we value something. We'd like it, but it's not going to enter their bottom line unless we do something to make it enter their bottom line. And passing a premium on to the farmer in the form of paying more for shade coffee or something, that's a great way to fix that externality.
Do you then have to have people who are willing to say, I will pay more for the value that I see in having biodiversity or in having natural landscapes? I mean, does that, somewhere down the line, does it require somebody to pay more just for the intrinsic value of having whatever landscape or animal we're talking about here?
Yes and no. I mean, so Walmart a few years ago decided to go to all MSC, Marine Stewardship Council fish. So that means all the fish that you sell in Walmart is going to have some standard of sustainability. Now, you can question of whether that actually happens on the ground because it's so hard to monitor our supply chains for fish. But the word on the street is they didn't pass that cost on to their customers. They did that because if other people were doing it, it might bite into their profit chain. So, but in many cases, in most of the cases, I think you're right, is that you need to find somebody at the end who's willing to pay more. People like Walmart can operate without willing, you know, without that willingness to pay. But the coffee example is one, but there's a whole suite of commodities now that have this kind of certification. So palm oil, chocolate, soy, sugarcane, major, major global commodities.
Timber too.
Yeah.
Yeah. FSC, you can go to Lowe's or Home Depot and see Forest Stewardship Council certified timber.
Brenda, did I interrupt you with
that? No.
Timber
query? I interrupted him, actually.
Interrupt away.
Well, listeners, you can interrupt us as well if you have an example that you want to share. If you think about these issues in the purchases that you make, where do you see the cost-benefit analysis coming down for you? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a call from Jared in Wallingford, Pennsylvania, who couldn't stay on the line, but he says he'd love to have you talk about how economics and conservation are coming together in the current water shortage crisis in California. I mean, that's a big one we're all hearing about right now. And certainly when we think of the drought in California and the use of water, so much of it is applied to agriculture. And now we're seeing individuals be told they need to conserve their water. But you know, when you look at the economic benefit of the agriculture we see in California, that's huge. So I know it's a big concept that you perhaps were not prepared to talk about today, but Taylor, we're going to put you on the spot.
Okay, so I'm starting. Great.
Oh, I was just going to say.
All right, Brendan, we're putting you on the spot.
I was just going to say, hi, Jared. My whole family lives in Wallingford, Pennsylvania.
Oh, so is this a ringer,
small
perhaps?
World. I don't know any Jareds.
All right.
That's your contribution?
That's it. You have to solve California's water problem.
So, you know, this is dangerous political territory, but it's just true of any commodity that the price sends a signal. So the cost of water anywhere, including the cost of water in California, can either encourage or discourage big use of water, right? So, and the same is true of fuel or any kind of energy source. So I think one of the things that California is going to have to look at and is now, you can regulate water, say stop taking showers, or you can send price signals, and which is a sort of a more economic way of thinking about it. So it could be that if water is priced appropriately in California, there are some forms of agriculture that don't make economic sense anymore in California. It could be that if water is priced appropriately in California, that there are certain types of development or housing projects that don't go in California. So I think California is going to have to think about, and I know they are thinking about, the economics of how water is supplied and paid for and what kind of activity that's encouraged. And it's much more complicated than we're saying it is right now, but that's going to have to be part of it. There's a lot of evidence that a small charges on water reduce use dramatically. And that's going to have to be part of the mix, I think.
And I think it's another good example of the scarcity issue. I mean, the economic kind of framework works within the environment, right? So when you have global or ecological scarcity, the economic system works underneath that. So unless you get that ecological functioning correctly, we can't solve our water problem by raising the price if there's no more water. So the economic system isn't going to fix the ecological system, but the economic system can help us manage the effects of changes in the ecological system.
Well, that follows nicely with a question that Chris in Middlebury is posing. He says, should we pay people not to pollute, or should we charge them for polluting?
So that's another great question. So one of the things that I get from students who are first kind of taking economics from environmental economics is, what do you mean the right level of pollution? Well, there's a right level of pollution. And so you can imagine that some pollutant costs a lot of money to get the last few units of it out of the river or out of the air. But the first few units are actually quite cheap. So that's where society decides that if it's very costly to get those last few units, it might be better for us to spend that money somewhere else. The idea of paying people not to pollute versus paying people, charging people to pollute is a really good one. This goes back to how we treat money and our willingness to accept versus our willingness to pay. And it's something that we get in the literature. I think one of the problems with that question is that it really depends on how endowed people are with their initial set of opportunities and resources. So fining large companies for their pollutants seems to be a pretty good a way forward. Finding individuals who might not have a lot of resources and demanding them to do kind of abatement effects, say, on their farm, if they don't have extra spare capital, it's going to cost them a lot. And so this initial endowment is really important to think about what are the appropriate policies to improve conservation outcomes.
So how would you look at that, say, in Lake Champlain cleanup here? We certainly are already dealing with a pollution problem. We're also looking at the causes of pollution, runoff. We're looking at individuals who can cause pollution. And again, speaking of agriculture, we're looking at agricultural practices that cause phosphorus to go into the water. So how do we do that when you talk about farmers who perhaps don't have the capital outlay to put in these pollution mitigation techniques and you know, forms on their farm?
Yeah, it's another example of an externality, not to keep beating on that one. But, you know, the reason we have a pollution problem in Lake Champlain is the result of thousands of small household level, farm level economic decisions, right? Probably pretty good ones from a bottom line point of view of their private enterprise. The problem is that those carry externalities. Those pass pollutants onto a public good, which is the lake. And so how we deal with that from a policy point of view is in part informed by economics, but only partly. And it gets back to your the question earlier, whether we charge polluters or we pay people not to. And a lot of that comes down to the sort of philosophy, is it a right to be able to kind of dispose of waste in common resources, or is it the right for everyone else to have clean ones? And depending on which answer you have to that, which is kind of a philosophical one, the policy of pay or charge is the more appropriate one. But from Lake Champlain's point of view, I think in the mix of solutions, it's going to have to be internalizing, so to speak, that externality, somehow sending farmers a price signal to pay them to reduce pollution.
That's Taylor Ricketts. We're also talking with Brendan Fisher. They're both UVM professors who've written a field guide to economics for conservationists, along with Robin Nadeau. And they're helping us understand how these concepts can be applied to real-life situations that we are all familiar with. If you'd like to add your question, you can call us, 1-800-639-2211. That's 800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're getting a lot of comments coming in here on our webpage and Facebook. George Plum, who's executive director of Vermonters for Sustainable Population, wrote in with this comment. The sixth great extinction of wildlife is caused by population growth and not just economics. In the last 40 years, the population of the Earth has surged by 40%, while the quantity of wildlife has plummeted by 40%. When are environmentalists and economists going to address the elephant in the room? So the elephant in the room being population growth here.
Yeah.
Taylor, you're going to take this one on.
Sure, I'll take it on. I think, yeah. I just drew the short straw on this one, so I'll start. Brendan can start the next one. It is the elephant in the room. Both Brendan and I worked at a conservation organization, and it's remarkable how much it's an elephant in the room there as well. It's hard to have a conversation of any length about environmental problems and sustainability without that conversation coming to rest on the problem of population. It's sort of the end point of all such conversations in my experience. And it is true. Economics is not going to solve that. Other forms of environmental action aren't going to solve that. It really is part of the mix. It's a difficult one to talk about. It's a difficult one for organizations to kind of stake out big claims behind, but that doesn't make it any less of a big problem. I think I would modify what he said a little bit in that population is growing, but so is per capita consumption a lot. So the average amount that a global citizen consumes per person is rising much faster now than the population. So it is one part of the solution, but there are other ones as well that can be tackled alongside it. With developing countries of the size of China and India coming on, that's picked up the pace of the consumption part of that equation.
Yeah, and I would just like to add to Taylor's point is that, if you look at the footprint of countries across the world, most of the countries that have the largest footprint, so the carbon footprint, the eco footprint, however you want to measure, the biggest impact on the environment are countries with stable or low population growth. So it really is one of the major drivers is consumption. It's not necessarily population. And if we frame it differently and think about sub-Saharan Africa or the developing world, population growth is often very much a function of rational decision-making for people whose children are dying, and so you have more, and also because of the need to have somebody to look after you when you're older. So these are very rational, important, and ethically correct, I would say, drivers of population growth. So really, maybe one of the things we need to reframe it as, hey, let's have better welfare for people in these places that that are suffering.
Although you do see economic reasons for driving population growth in some developed nations as well. You see in Japan, we've seen sometimes in Russia a call for have more babies because we don't have people to fill the jobs. Our economy is not going to withstand this level of population decline. So you see it in the other side, too, is not just communities that are facing real hardship and deprivation.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, there is an optimal level of population replacement. And there's a famous economist back in the 70s named Kenneth Boulding who said we should have permits for having children. Everybody's endowed with 1.1 permit for having a child. And everyone laughed him at the time. But who knows in the future? I mean, you could trade these permits if you want more kids. People don't want kids. They can sell them on the market.
Oh, gosh. Now we're getting into like wow. Orwellian here.
That was Brendan Fisher talking, just to be.
We got a note from Alan in Middlesex who says, why not include all of the cost of products in the initial purchase price, such as including the cost of recycling product packaging in the price of the product instead of making society bear these recycling costs or making Walmart pay the cost of recycling their product packaging? So sort of tangential to the idea of conservation, but certainly part of the mix when you're talking about consumption and those kind of drivers.
That's Taylor. A fantastic point. I would say the same thing. Why not do that? I think this sort of cradle-to-cradle type idea where the price of disposing a product is built into its price is a great way to, again, send a signal of more easily disposable or reusable or recyclable will wind up being cheaper, and that's a great incentive. So unfortunately, companies that produce these things don't have that incentive because they don't bear the cost of disposal themselves very often. So again, trying to internalize those factors into decisions is a fantastic idea.
And they do this in several sectors in Germany. So you can actually, over the years, see the size and the width or the density of plastic water bottles decrease because manufacturers have to pay the cost of whatever's going to happen to the end of that water bottle, whether it be in the landfill or in recycling. So the signal was shown, and the production companies responded.
Let's go to Hans, who's calling in from Charlotte. Hi, Hans. Go ahead.
Hello. Good afternoon. I would like to ask Professors Fisher and Rickensay to make some comments about the carbon tax that is presently being discussed in the Vermont legislature.
Hans, thanks for the call. What about this, the idea of a carbon tax? Where do you fall on that?
So I love it, actually. This is
again,
another...
that's Brendan.
This is a great way to internalize a cost that we externalize right now and everybody pays the cost of. So if you can send some kind of signal that tells people, hey, this is actually a pollutant. This is something that affects us in a wider sense, both in Vermont and globally. The market and these taxes are actually quite a good way to at least begin to correct the problem.
All right, so we got a note from Donna who posted on our Facebook page saying, I hate economics. It's like voodoo BS. So before I let you go, you have one last chance to convince Donna and others why understanding economic principles is important to conservation and perhaps important to all of us.
Yeah, that makes me sad to hear that. I think economics is actually really cool. It explains a ton of the world if you understand it right. I think we teach economics in a dreadful way on average. I think the books are dense and difficult, but the main concepts are really intuitive. And when you get them, you start seeing them everywhere. The idea of opportunity costs and externalities, these are fancy sounding words, but you can watch your friends react to them and behave according to them. It's this great insight into what can guide behavior. Not everything about guiding behavior, but a big chunk of it.
And I'd just say, Donna, economics is about trying to understand decision making. So I'm sure you make decisions every day. That's economics. That's trying to understand what you're doing. And I promise you that this will, or at least I hope that if you were to look at our book, it'll be the least dreadful and boring and voodoo of them all.
All right. And the book is called A Field Guide to Economics for Conservationists. How's that for a plug? It will be the least boring economics textbook you've ever read. It's by Brendan Fisher, Robin Nadeau, and Taylor Ricketts. Taylor Ricketts and Brendan Fisher, both UVM professors who've been with us this hour talking about the concepts. Thank you for sharing them with us.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, did you see the movie Wild and think, I could do that? No? Well, the Appalachian Trail Conservancy is worried that a lot of people answered yes. They're anticipating more people crowding onto the 2,000-mile trail this summer. We're going to get the scoop next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Each year, a couple thousand people attempt to hike the 2,180-mile or so Appalachian Trail end-to-end from Georgia to Maine or from Maine to Georgia with a small section that crosses through Vermont. These people are called thru-hikers, and this year the Appalachian Trail Conservancy is worried that the high-profile movies Wild and A Walk in the Woods are going to entice people who aren't very well prepared to attempt their own thru-hiking adventure. Kevin Matheny is the New England Regional Director of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. He goes by his trail name, Hawk, and he joins us now to talk a little bit about this influx of hikers. Hawk, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Jane. Happy to be here.
So do you really think these movies, Wild, that's already out, and A Walk in the Woods, it's just starting to be seen by people, premiered at the Sundance Festival, that's going to inspire people to say, I'm going to take 5 months out and thru-hike the Appalachian Trail?
You know, there's a pretty good chance it will, Jane. Historically, when the trail has been profiled in popular media, either through books or movies, we've seen a corresponding spike in visitation to the trail. And the fact that two, Hollywood movies that are getting a fair amount of attention or either have come out or will come out later this year could lead to a even higher increase than we've seen in previous promotions.
Now, for somebody like you who's working with the Trail Conservancy, isn't that a good thing that you get people more interested in the trail, more interested in using it and in experiencing this adventure?
It is a good thing. You know, having people get more familiar with the trail, getting experience on it, and help to support it over time. That's the positive side of this. At the same time, we have to make sure that people are informed about the experience that they are undertaking and that they're prepared, and that, excuse me, that they're aware of leave no trace practices so that they minimize their impact when they're out there.
And is that a problem? Do you find that people do attempt this kind of hike and not aren't prepared or haven't done the research to figure out how they're going to actually make it work?
Yeah, typically the patterns are fairly consistent from one year to the next. We have fairly accurate use numbers starting down at Springer Mountain in Georgia or starting at Katahdin in Maine. And about 25% of those who attempt a through hike actually complete it. So we have 75% attrition rate. And majority of those occur actually in just the first 100 or 200 miles, or sometimes even less. There's some cases, you know, in the first 30 or 40 miles. So while a movie can show sort of the glamour and the fun side of a through hike, there are realities out there from, you know, terrain to constantly changing weather to getting used to carrying a pack every day and just the rigor.
Have you through hiked the AT?
I have.
Tell us a little bit about what, you know, what that was like for you. I know it's impossible to encapsulate in just one answer, but it must have been, if you've done it more than once, a pretty incredible experience.
It is an incredible experience. It's what I would call a true adventure, a true challenge. You know, it's a 4 to 6 month undertaking, so it becomes a significant part of your life for that period of time. I mean, it is your life. It's your lifestyle. More so than just, you know, going for a backpack for a week or two and then, you know, back into your everyday life. So you become immersed in a landscape, immersed in a community, discover things perhaps about yourself that you may not have a chance to realize if you're, you know, busy working and juggling family life and all. So it was a very influential experience in my life. I did it back in 1993, but I've stayed involved with the trail since, working with either a trail club or most recently with the Appalachian Trail Conservancy.
So one of the new things for people who might be considering a trail hike is that there's a registration process, and it's voluntary, but the idea is you register where you're planning to start and what day. And why do you think that's going to help, particularly with this overcrowding issue for people starting out at the same day, at the same point on the trail?
Right. That's something new we launched this year back in February in anticipation of not just the influence that these two movies may have, but also that we're currently seeing an upswing in numbers of visitors on the trail. For about the past 6 or 7 years, we've been seeing about a 10% increase per year. So we developed this system that allows people to go to our website, which is appalachiantrail.org, and register when they are expecting to start their through hike, and they can see, periodically we update it, so they can see on a graph how many others have registered and whether or not, you know, that is a particularly popular time or less so. And in the past, people didn't have that information until they arrived mostly at the southern terminus. About 80% of people who through hike go northbound from Georgia to Maine. So they might think that they picked a good day for whatever reason, and they get out there and they realize 30, 40, 60, even up to 100 people had picked that day. So now they have a graphical representation online before they start their hike, and they can see what these use patterns look like. And what we've experienced so far, we've just updated as of April 5th, so just a few days ago, is more of an evening out of the use compared to what we saw in the past. There were 4 or 5 days every spring you could predict there would be, you know, more than the average number. It was March 1st, March 15th, the first day of spring, April 1st, and most weekends.
Huh. And you could get, what, maybe 100 or two people instead of five or six?
That would be the high end. It might be as many as 60 or so on those popular days. And now, if you happen to look on our website, you see that that's much more evened off. We're seeing 25 and 30 on average on a given day, maybe as low as 20.
And that's better for the trail?
It is. I think it's better both experientially for the hiker, but also for the resource. You know, we have limits in how many people can be accommodated at a given overnight site on a given night. So there might be, in the past, there might have been 40 people, maybe 50 at one site on a night, one of these popular days that I mentioned. And then the next night, there's 10. So we're just trying to even it out.
That's Kevin Hawk Matheny. He's New England Regional Director of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. We will put a list or a link to the Trail Conservancy on our website, vpr.net. Kevin Hawk, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Jane.
I also want to invite you, if you are a long-distance hiker, maybe a thru-hiker of the AT, go to the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Tell us why you hike and tell us your trail name. Tell us the story behind your trail name. All right, that wraps up today's program. Tomorrow, the marketplace of peer-to-peer services. Have you gotten a ride from Uber or used Airbnb on vacation? These kinds of platforms for freelance services are growing, and so are questions about reliability, insurance, and consumer protection. On the next Vermont Edition, we'll look at how Vermont is handling those questions. And if you've used or provided Uber, Airbnb, or similar services, you can tell us about that. Email vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Devin Karambulis and Amanda Shepherd. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.